Oh, then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, tell me why you hurry so. Hush, you vocal, hush and listen, and his cheeks were all aglow. I bear orders from the captain, get you ready quick and soon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. Oh, then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, where the gathering is to be. In the old spot by the river, right well known to you and me. One more roar for signal token, whistle up the marching tune, for your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, with your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. Out from many a mud wall cabin eyes were watching through the night. Many a manly chest was throbbing for the blessed warning light. Farmers passed along the valleys like the man she's lonely crew.
Greetings from the Northwest homeland, comrades. It's November the 3rd, 2011. I'm Harold Covington, and this is Radio Free Northwest.
There beside the singing river, that dark mass of men were seen. Far above their shining weapons, on their own beloved green. Death to every foe and traitor, forward strike the marching tune.
The official date of this podcast is November the 3rd, 2011, which is the 32nd anniversary of the Greensboro shootings on November the 3rd, 1979. Some people suggested that I sit and have a whole long dissertation on the real story behind Greensboro, and I'm probably one of the few people left around who actually knows the real story and could tell it if he chose, but no, I'm not going to do that, because it's been my experience down through the years that nobody really wants to hear it, including a lot of people on our side. So instead of that little bit of nostalgia, I'm going to mention something that I heard on Glenn Beck this morning. Now, I am not a big fan by any means of Glenn Beck, let me make that clear. But like Rush Limbaugh, occasionally he makes some good points. And I think he made a good point this morning. He was talking about an article that he had seen on the internet some days or weeks ago about the Solyndra scandal, wherein the Obama administration lent something like $500 million to this company that then caused the money to vanish someplace and declared bankruptcy and laid off all their workers. The whole thing, frankly, reeks of some kind of payoff to George Soros, still paying back that money that mysteriously appeared in Obama's bank accounts off the internet during the 2008 election campaign. Anyway, Beck had noted something about this article. He didn't even say where it was from, or if he did, I didn't hear it. But what he did say was that when he went on to Google trying to find the article again to refer to it on his show, he couldn't find it. Now, he knew for a fact that this article was out there, and he tried every imaginable combination of words that he could remember from the article to try and bring it up. Now, I've had this very same experience. We know that Google can manipulate their own search engine and dictate what kind of response that searchers get to certain combinations of words. And apparently, there's some kind of manipulation of this kind going on with relation to the Obama administration and scandals like Solyndra and no doubt things like Fast and Furious and various things that discredit our Munkoid-in-chief and so forth and so on. And this, of course, doesn't surprise me, but Beck used this to make a very good point. He urges his own people, his fan club, if you will, and he has quite a big one, whether we like him or not. There are a lot of white people who set a great deal of store by Glenn Beck. Yes, I know he's a Zionist. I know he's a Jew lover. I know he's an asshole. I'm simply saying that there are a lot of white people who can't see past that and who do set a good deal of store by him. Anyway, Beck suggested that his following start keeping journals and writing down on paper the various things that happen day by day, because he said something which I think is very prescient. In some respects, we white people who are alive today are going to be like the monks of medieval Europe. We are going to be charged with keeping alive the knowledge of what happened in our times, because this electronic media that we are now substituting newspapers and books and the printed word with is, of course, a lot more versatile, but by that very token, it means it's a lot more fallible and a lot more alterable than the pure written word. I've already said on this program once or twice before that one interesting thing, one possibly good thing about the internet is that once something is on the internet, it's out there forever. But that's not totally true. It may be out there on the internet, but anyone who knows how to manipulate search engines and anyone who can gain power over outfits like Google and Yahoo and these big internet media corporations and who can thereby control the parameters of search engines, how search engines function, so forth and so on, can still, in effect, bury certain forbidden knowledge, certain inconvenient facts, etc., by making it impossible to find on the internet. Now, another thing about the internet is that there is just so much of it. The amount of gigabytes of data on the internet right now on various servers and floating around in various archives and so forth and so on just boggles the mind. And I think the statistic is still that 90% of it is porn. But if you are tech savvy and you have power and you have the will to abuse that power, it is still possible to control human knowledge by controlling what can be found and what can be pulled up and what can be viewed on the internet and by whom. And I think Beck does make a very good point there. There's a second point that he makes, which is something I think we also need to bear in mind, and that is that electronic forms of communication and information storage are, what would be the word, fungible, alterable. They're not immutable, put it that way. We've already seen through Photoshop and through the alterations on the audio tapes of Edgar Steele that photographs and audio tapes can indeed lie. And so we need to beware to some degree of any kind of information or anything we find on the internet because it might not necessarily be so. If it deals with a sensitive subject like, say, Solyndra or Obama or the Jews or Israel or something like that, someone may well have gotten at that particular file and made alterations to it. If it deals with current events, 5 years, 10 years, 15 years from now, somebody with a vested interest in rewriting history might have gotten to that file and changed things, or they might have added things. So the fact is that as versatile and as potentially effective as all these various electronic media having to do with the internet and cable TV and whatnot are, they can't really be trusted because they can be altered. The written word itself cannot be altered. It can be forged, but electronic documents can be altered if you spot the difference. So for this reason, I think it is a very good idea for us to maintain a written hard copy format. This is why, although I am now distributing the white book on the internet in PDF format for free, I am also arranging for a printed book form so that people can have a hard copy of the white book. That, by the way, is also called the Northwest Migration Manual 4th Edition. That's why I've always arranged for my novels to be published in actual book form as well, not ebook or Kindle, so forth and so on. It's also why we have our monthly newsletter, the Northwest Observer. It strikes me that many of you guys out there don't actually know about the Observer, so for those of you who don't know about it, we do publish a 16-page newsletter every month, or magazine, small magazine, called the Northwest Observer. Subscription rates are $30 per year. We find this puts us kind of head and shoulders above most other groups in the movement because just about everybody else has gone completely onto the internet now. This makes us especially of interest to prisoners and other people who don't have access to personal computers, and it makes us of interest to elderly people who don't quite fathom computers, don't understand them, and don't own them, and also for certain people who just plain have made the decision not to own personal computers and not to have these machines in their lives, which is more than you might think. Anyway, I just thought I'd mention that for those of you who weren't aware of the fact that, yes, we do actually publish a monthly fanzine or bulletin, whatever you want to call it, like I said, called Northwest Observer. It's $30 a year. If you're interested in a subscription, you can email me at nwnet@earthlink.net.
Commander Rockwell used to say that if the American people were suddenly dropped in a cauldron of boiling water, they would immediately jump out and attack whoever did it. But, on the other hand, if Americans were placed in a pot of lukewarm water and the heat were turned up slowly, they wouldn't notice they were being cooked until it was too late. It seems that's true with nearly every aspect of life today. We're all slowly cooking, and some would say we are already tenderized to the point of no return. If we measure what we have become against what we once were, we would notice a stark difference. In the area of history, for instance, our children are taught in the public schools, paid for with our tax money, that the white man is evil and has been the cause of all the world's misery. Blacks and other MUDs are given credit for the building of civilizations they never created, and they are being handed the future of the planet.
Well, this line of teaching wasn't always so. A few of us are old enough to remember when kids were taught actual, for real history in public schools. Now, the problem is that public schools are now controlled almost entirely by the National Education Association, which is the National Teachers Union, and the NEA is, for all practical purposes, just a wing of the Democratic Party in the Obama administration. The realization of this process was recently brought home to me by the discovery of an 8th grade history book that I found at a library sale. The school textbook was entitled The Story of Our English Grandfathers, and it was written in 1905 by one George P. Brown. It was published in Bloomington, Illinois by the Public School Publishing Company. As I paged through this book, I was amazed at the stark differences in which history is taught today as compared to 100 years ago. Reading the introduction to this book was a real wake-up call. I imagined what would happen if 8th graders today were taught this material. The teacher would immediately be fired and probably prosecuted and sent to prison, while the students would be sent to psychological reprogramming and sensitivity awareness clinics so they could be denazified.
One of the suggestions I've made to Harold is that when he gets some extra time, whenever that might be, he should write a history book for young white kids to counter all the politically correct crap that they're getting in public schools.
In a way, I've already got a start on that with my Weird Aryan History series that I send out by email every 6 months. Now, some of those pieces I wrote myself, and some I cribbed from other authors. But yeah, I could imagine writing a kind of a primer or textbook on proper American history for white kids as an antidote to the PC bullshit they teach in school these days. I would have to reduce it to the bare simplicities. I would tell the kids that the white people who first came to this country were Europeans, starting with the Vikings in the 11th century, and then followed by the settlers who came after Columbus. I would tell them that those who settled in Canada originally were French, and those who settled on the Atlantic coast from Maine to Florida were mostly Englishmen and Scots, with a healthy seasoning of Germans and Dutchmen in New York and even a few Swedes down around Delaware.
I also think it's important for American kids to understand that, in turn, the ancestors of the English settlers were those Germans who lived north of the Elbe River in Germany and near to the coast of the North Sea. If we call the early English people our grandfathers, we have to claim those early German people as our great-grandfathers. All white people, not just kids, need to understand that Americans and Europeans are all members of one great family or race, and that English and Germans and Scandinavians are of the same family of people, the Germanic family, which in history is called the Teutonic race.
Later on came waves of Irish and Welsh to build the railroads and work in the mines of the 19th century. Now, this is why we have so many people named Jones or Evans. Many of the white inhabitants of Ireland, Wales, and Scotland had ancestors of another race called the Britons, who lived in England when our great-grandfathers, the Germans, first came into the island. Now, these people are known in history as the Celtic or Celtic race. In fact, very many Englishmen have Celtic as well as German ancestors. All the people in Great Britain and Ireland are closely related by blood to one another and to the Americans. The Celtic blood that commingled with the Germanic Saxons created some differences between the English and the American people on the one hand and the German people of Europe on the other. But in all essential ways, the three nations are one great family and ought to live in peace and friendship with each other.
The early settlers in the United States were mostly Englishmen, with a minority of Germans and the odd little minority like French Protestants in South Carolina and Dutch in New York. When they became a separate nation, they framed a plan of government which was the United States Constitution and which was intended to be the most fundamental and binding of all American laws because it lays out certain basic rights of the people and how the government is obligated to protect these rights. You'd be amazed at how little white kids these days know about the U.S. Constitution. A lot of them confuse it with the Declaration of Independence, and in some cases white kids are never taught at all about the Bill of Rights, but just about stuff like the 14th Amendment, which is used to claim that niggers are equal.
If an American wants to know the early history of his own customs and laws, he has to know the early history of the Europeans, and especially the British people. Since it was England that gave us our language and our laws dating from the Magna Carta of 1215, and of course our founding fathers. This hypothetical book that I would write would be a brief history of those customs and events in the lives of our English grandfathers, telling us the things that concern us all to know, and which the young white people of America need to learn if they would fully understand who they are and how they got here. Tacitus, one of the greatest of Roman historians, wrote as follows of our German great-grandfathers: "A fine, unmixed, and independent race, unlike any other people, with stern blue eyes, ruddy hair, of large and robust frames, but with a strength which only appears when roused to sudden effort. They will be the slaves of no man. They respect their women and hold them in love and honor. They consider no disgrace equal to that which is the sure reward of a man who shows himself a coward in battle. Fierce and cruel in war, they are content, when the war is over, to lay aside the sword and spear, and to plow their fields and to cultivate the lands in peace and quiet." Now, this is one of the earliest historical descriptions of our Aryan racial ancestors and the way they lived in their natural state in the forests of Northern Europe. Yet your average white kid these days has no idea about any of this. He thinks history began with Ren and Stimpy.
Ren and Stimpy. If the teachers, professors, and historians of 100 years ago have been able to glimpse the future through a kind of crystal ball and realize, they would freak out in horror. They simply wouldn't understand how their descendants could ever be so stupid as to consider niggers equal or let millions of Mexicans swarm into the country uncontrolled. We are slowly being boiled alive in a cauldron of racial destruction where each day the heat is slowly turned up, and soon there will be no tomorrow for the white race. On the other hand, if white Americans could all look back to a time of racial sanity and see through real history where we once were, they would extricate themselves from the fire of racial oblivion. Adolf Hitler said it best: "If a people is defeated in its struggle for human rights, this merely means they have been found too light in the scale of destiny for the happiness of survival on this earth. When a people is no longer willing or able to fight for its existence, Providence, in its eternal justice, has decreed that people's end."
We got a very good reaction to our bullshit session last week between me and Sally and Wallace. We're probably going to do that again from now on a fairly regular basis. We're not going to do it this week because I do have this absolute howler of a cold, and we've only got one microphone here, and I don't want us three sharing a mic. There's no point in my giving Sally and Wallace my disease here. But I mentioned last week a group called the Weathermen, and I was rather amazed at the number of you guys out there who never even heard of the Weathermen. What they were a bunch of quasi-lefty, commie, hippy-dippy revolutionary types in the late 60s and early 70s, kind of like Occupy Wall Street today, only these were the original hippies. Occupy Wall Street really doesn't have much on the flower power generation and the original Weathermen and the original hippies. You know, backlash never replays like the original. But I was nattering with a guy on email, and he said maybe I should give you guys a little rundown as to what it was like growing up in the true hippy-dippy years. We have some people in our movement who tell me that their parents were hippies, and that's one of the reasons they became white nationalists, but I'm probably a little bit more au fait with the actual hippie scene as it really was, and I'm sure a lot of you have seen the whole hippy-dippy flower power Weatherman 60s radical scene portrayed in the movies, on TV, everything like that, and you probably think it's an exaggeration. No, not really. Yes, people really were like that back then, as bizarre as it may sound. Some of them still really are. You've still got these 60s retreads, you might say, who are now in their 60s. You know, I'm sure that would be an interesting slogan. The 60s generation is now in their 60s, but they're still staggering around the communes, and you know, I imagine there's still a few staggering around Haight-Ashbury in San Francisco going, "Wow, man, far out, man." Tripping over the junkies and the burned out derelict cars and the gutted buildings and everything that was left over from that era. It's really hard to describe what it was like to be a non-conforming teenager back then. And by non-conforming, I mean non-hippy-dippy, non-leftist, non-dope-smoking, non-nigger-loving, power-to-the-people type of kid, because in the high school that I was thrown into at age 15, Chapel Hill High School, that was the orthodoxy, and anyone who varied from it was very much out of step. I can honestly say that my experiences at Chapel Hill High during that time made me what I am today, for better or worse. There was, of course, the racial situation with the niggers, which was a direct result of this whole hippy-dippy attitude, but it's very hard to explain to someone who wasn't there. Of course, I suppose that applies to any generation. Anyway, what I'm saying is that for my generation, Vietnam and the whole hippy-dippy flower power scene, etc., this was where the great sort of divergence in American culture between the red states and the blue states and conservatives and liberals and whatnot began. Some commentator, I think it might have been Gary Trudeau, said a few years ago in something I've read somewhere, he said that in order to understand what's going on today, you have to understand that it's all about the 60s. I'm not quite sure if I can really convey exactly what it was like back then. I may try a little bit later on in this podcast. What I can do is try and convey that via the music. Now, when I first entered Chapel Hill High School in the autumn of 1968, this was the big hit song on all the radio. It's by Kenny Rogers. And you guys, I'm sure today, will think it's kind of exaggerated, but I swear to God, I knew kids at that high school who walked through all 3 years in exactly this kind of state of being stoned. Hell, they probably walked through their whole lives as stoned as this.
I woke up this morning with the sundown shining in. I found my mind in a brown paper bag, but then I tripped on a cloud and fell 8 miles high. I tore my mind on a jagged sky. I just dropped in to see what condition my condition was in.
Yeah, yeah, oh yeah, what condition my condition was in.
I pushed my soul in a deep dark hole and then I followed it in. I watched myself crawling out as I was crawling in. I got up so tight I couldn't unwind. I saw so much I broke my mind. I just dropped in to see what condition my condition was in. On a dead end sign, I had my foot on the gas as I left the road and blew out my mind. 8 miles out of Memphis and I got no spare. 8 miles straight up downtown somewhere. I just dropped in to see what condition my condition was in.
Okay, I'm going to play this next cut with some reluctance. I know I said I wasn't going to do this anymore, but on Halloween morning, appropriately enough, I hear this knock on the door, And I open it and I find our former official token nigger, Dry Ice Washington, outside sitting on the steps muttering to himself with a bottle of Thunderbird. He smelled like the dumpster down at the Pike Place Fish Market, which I think is where he'd been sleeping, and he was wearing a Herman Cain for President button. Anyway, he wanted to come on the show again and say some things, so I figured, as long as he was here, what the hell. "This is Dry Ice Washington, and I've been rapping at your ass here on Radio Free Northwest. I used to be giving you old-phased news and views from the African-American community, but I ain't doing that shit no more. Now I be speaking into the archives of gravity in my new capacity as the chairman of the Seattle chapter of the ANC, Authentic Niggers for Cain. See, what it is, I'm an authentic black man, like the Reverend Jesse Jackson say. Up with dope, down with hope, I am a nigger. Herman Cain be an authentic black man, too, old blue gum Geechee nigger from Georgia. But that long-legged Mac Daddy Barack Obama ain't really an authentic nigger. I mean, he may be African-American, since his daddy was some Kunta Kinte nigger from over in Africa someplace. His mama be some white hippie bitch who probably so high on Maui Wow she didn't know what she was fucking that night. But that still don't make Barack Obama a real nigger. He just a high yellow, what we used to call a red bone. I mean, you look at his ass, he ain't black, he kind of baby shit brown. Now, Barack Obama, what they call light and bright, except in his case, he light and stupid. Now, we had enough of that. We needs us a real nigger in the White House, nigger like Herman Cain, who be black and stupid. Barack Obama don't make no sense at all without his teleprompter. Herman Cain, when he get to be president, ain't gonna rely on no goddamn teleprompter, because the nigger can't read. Herman Cain got him all kinds of experience as a businessman. For many years, he were the CEO of Godfather's Pizza, which be the worst pizza in the whole country. You ever ate a Godfather's Pizza? Tastes like shit on a shingle. Now, how making a bad pizza qualify anybody to be president of the United States ain't nobody know, but then if qualifications was to mean anything anymore, Barack Obama would never set his redbone ass down in the Oval Office. I mean, you know, Barack Obama ain't shit. He never done nothing before he went to the White House. At least Herman Cain can make pizza. Now, they're all talking about Herman Cain done be sexually harassing these women 15 years ago. Like anybody give a damn. They just trying to do the same thing to Herman like they did to my man Long Dong Silver. But he on the Supreme Court now anyway. So if Herman Cain get elected, we now can have two sexually harassing blue gum niggas get together in the White House and sexually harass both of them together. Maybe to harass that whole Michelle off of her a can of Coke. I mean, what the hell? Might as well have another nigga in the White House. You white folks ain't fucking no more, and you ain't having any more white babies, so all you pale asses gonna be gone in a few years anyway, and then we all gonna be niggas, or Mexicans. So all you honkies, vote for Herman Cain for president. Herman Cain gonna give you 999, and now Hal Cunningham say he gonna give me a 40, so I'll be out of here. By the way, you guys out there can laugh, but as of right now, it looks like Herman Cain is headed for a win in the Iowa caucuses and in the New Hampshire Republican primary. Many a true word said in jest, I'm afraid.
Hi guys, this is Axis Sally. First, I want to say thank you to the loyal fan who sent me some really nice photographs of Adolf Hitler. I love to get stuff in the mail, especially stuff from fans that I can put in my big box of Nazi stuff, so feel free to keep sending things. And here is this week's reading. We are at war. Zionist scum want us dead, whether that death be physical, moral, and spiritual, or the kind of death that occurs when our bloodline is ended. I've been following the news stories of a skinhead couple who went on what the media is calling a three-state killing spree, and after they were apprehended, preservation of the white race and fighting in this war would be the reasons they gave for their actions. I'm starting to wonder if they're making up things as they go along. From what I can see, their first two victims were killed out of revenge, and then seeing as how they had to run, they managed to kill two more people in order to steal their cars, and could conveniently make up racially conscious reasons for doing so. First they said they thought one of them was Jewish, then they recanted and said they actually just wanted to steal his car and were hoping he was Jewish so they could say he deserved to be killed. So we have four dead, three white and one black. And now we have two young white people who will be lucky to escape the death penalty. Either way, this means two white bloodlines that have ended and several more racially conscious Aryan children that will never exist. All for the sake of fighting the war on Zionism. Or, more accurately, for killing people and pretending it was all for the greater good. The female half of this couple has a 2-year-old son. She didn't realize she'd already made a huge step in winning the war. Every white woman who has chosen her own race rather than the mud races pushed on her by the Jewish media has already won, and every white child born is yet another victory for our survival. This woman had already won, had already done the greatest thing any woman can ever do for the white race. Her latest actions were a giant step backward. Actions such as hers will make sure that hate crime laws become harsher and that those who have racial tattoos or express any racially conscious beliefs and happen to become noticed by law enforcement are followed and tracked. Children born to such parents will be sent to special sensitivity training camps at public schools. This is a perfect example of what Harold refers to as the genuine revolutionary strategy versus the stupid illegal act. You know which one this is. Her actions did not elicit any change. They did not wipe out significant targets. Even if the victims had all been niggers or kikes, there would be 10,000 more where they came from. They are easily replaceable. Her presence in her child's life will not easily be replaced. The children she could have produced for our race will never be replaced. No matter how many other white couples have children, nothing will change the fact that there should have been a few more. This woman is 24 years old. Right now, she's doing everything she's not supposed to. Talking to the police, bragging to the media about her actions, and just generally making it clear that she believes her actions were valid and serve some great purpose. How will she feel in a few years when her ex-husband remarries and some other woman is raising her son and the visits start to become less frequent? Will she still be gloating over one nigger that her boyfriend shot? Or will she wish she had stuck around to see her son's baseball games and high school prom? If she's not dead by lethal injection in 20 years, will she be wishing she could meet her grandchildren, or will she be attempting to impress fellow inmates with stories of her murderous road trip? We are at war. Zionist scum want us dead, and this woman lost. A white child and the white race will forever suffer because of her actions. For those of us who want to win the war, by now you should know what to do and what not to do. Choose actions which will have great, long-term impacts on the future of your family and your race. Last week we heard from an aspiring new migrant who, let's face it, probably isn't coming home. He has to check with his wife, and I can already tell you how that's going to go. Harold mentioned that he wanted to hear from him or some others on their real experiences looking for a job in the homeland. I agree. I think some more real-time updates from migrants would be great. But I mean real migrants, people who are making the journey now and not next year and not after they ask their wives. I'm not a migrant. I was born and raised here in the homeland, and the only place outside the homeland I've lived is Alaska. I have now lived in 3 states in the homeland, and I'll share something personal with you. I've actually had bouts of homelessness. As recently as last winter, I'd spent some time on and off living in my car in a very cold state. The longest stretch was a week. I would wake up with snow in my car, and the car covered in so much snow that I couldn't open the door. Once I woke up to someone digging my car out of several feet of snow. The man had a Confederate flag bumper sticker and a gun rack in his truck. I love white people. Stuff like this demonstrates how tough white people can be when necessary. I'm just a tiny little girl. If I can live in these kinds of conditions rather than head to sunny California, what's your excuse? But what I'm trying to say is, my expensive college education that I still pay for did not guarantee me employment. It used to be that a high school diploma meant something. Local businesses were eager to hire recent graduates. Now, most of us know someone with a graduate degree who can't find work or who can only find part-time work that will never pay a salary that will allow him to pay off the money he spent on the education. And looking for a job is especially hard if you don't have access to an alarm clock, phone, shower, computer, laundry facilities, or regular meals. Many comrades have vague ideas of starting some sort of thing that will guarantee some work for fellow racialists, and these ideas don't usually pan out because people in the movement are flakes. Most likely, whatever they offer in terms of money or resources or employment does not exist, or it existed yesterday, but then something happened and now the cat is out of food and the car broke and their wife wasn't really too cool with the whole thing anyway. Just a word of advice, don't use people in the movement as character references on job applications. Just don't. So, for migrants and non-migrants alike, I'm sorry, but there is no National Labor Service in the Northwest Republic or anywhere else. You'll be completely on your own for finding a job, and you'll probably end up with something part-time with some weird schedule that makes it impossible to plan in advance for anything. You'll have to pretend to embrace diversity, and you'll go to sexual harassment seminars, which aren't as fun as they sound. And most of you will probably do something stupid like get a racial tattoo on your hand and then throw a temper tantrum about your rights when your boss catches it. But for those responsible people who didn't screw up their job prospects by acting like teenage thugs, I would like to hear from you. How is work in the homeland compared to work elsewhere? Or if you have lived only in the homeland, how do you balance your work with your obligation to racial service? Okay, you guys, I got a letter from my friend Morris Dees at the Southern Poverty Law Center, and apparently you have scared him again with your death threats. He enclosed a copy of one he received on April 20th of this year. I'm not sure why it took him so long to start crying about it. And I guess you told him to go to hell and that you were ready to die for what you believed in? Well, first of all, we know that's not true. You won't die for what you believe in unless you're allowed to smoke dope and bring your Game Boy with you. But anyway, my friend Morris, who is nice enough to email me regularly about what my other friends are up to, says threats like that keep him up at night. And, get this, he's not just worried about his own life. He's shaking in his boots over the possible danger to what he calls the dedicated people behind our courtroom victories and our work teaching tolerance in our nation's schools. That probably made no sense to most of you, so let me explain. By courtroom victories, he means those times he seized land and property of the people whose viewpoints he did not like, and by teaching tolerance, he means mandating homosexuality and race mixing for you. Got it? And what's really keeping him up at night is that he feels he's not doing enough to personally protect his gallant staff, but he came up with a way to help, and he emailed me his idea. He needs you to send him a special gift to cover the costs of fighting haters and extremists like, well, like you. Now, to be fair, he's not asking for money outright, he just mentions special gifts. So why don't you all send the money to the Northwest Front and the special gifts to my friend Morris Dees? I had an idea of a special gift I could send. I remembered a song by a band called Jew's Laughter, or maybe it was Jew Slaughter, that specifically mentioned Morris Dees by name in the title, even though for some reason there was a profanity in front of it. I thought maybe he would like his own personal copy of this, but when I tried to search for it online, the search engine pulled up a site called Israel's Top 10 Sexiest Models, and then I threw up in my mouth a little bit. So I'm all out of ideas. Remember, the role you play in your community is vitally important as well. Speak out against bigotry and intolerance whenever you see it. Working together, we can make a difference.
Okay, second music break. Now, I was maundering on earlier about the Weathermen back in the 1960s and the 70s. One of the great events that really fueled the whole Weatherman deal was the Kent State shootings on May the 4th, 1970. I was 16 at the time and in 11th grade, and we had all the local SDS types staging protests and demonstrations and whatnot over at Chapel Hill High. Now, that's the Students for a Democratic Society, which was the legal arm of the Weathermen. That's where I got my first taste of anti-communist action. The radicals came over from the university to try and recruit the high school kids and get them to riot and take over the school or some such mess. I can't remember exactly what the deal was. Although they ended up just wandering around the campus, making spaced out speeches full of hippy-dippy crap, smoking weed and drinking Ripple wine and yelling power to the people, and then by about 4 o'clock they wandered away. But in the morning, when they first came, me and my fellow grits, as we were called, the 6 or 7 tuition students from out in Orange County, who were there on a kind of affirmative action program, I guess you'd call it. Anyway, we threw rocks and those half-pint cartons of milk that they used to give us in school at them, and yelled a few anti-hippie slogans at them. It might actually have developed into a fight, but some of the male teachers appeared and chased us off. Anyway, Kent State was indeed a kind of a turning point, because that's when a lot of these dumbasses came to their senses and realized that revolution is serious business, and that if you really annoy the rich people with power, they're going to strike back eventually. Now, we didn't know it then, but Kent State was pretty much the high point of the whole so-called revolution of the 60s. The minute any actual blood was shed, all those hundreds of thousands of left-wing hippy-dippy jack-offs who were yelling power to the people and off the pig melted away like the morning dew in the sun. The vast majority of them shut the hell up and went back to class. The campuses were notably quiet when school started in the fall of 1970. Now today, most of them are probably yuppies pulling down six figures a year. But Kent State became a media icon for a whole generation, as they say. Well, not really, just a few thousand Jews and spaced out hippy-dippy freaks. But having the media on your side for 40 years will work wonders at concealing the reality of these things. Anyway, here's the most famous Kent State song. That was Neil Young, by the way. Okay, normally in this section of the podcast, I'd start my weekly rant and rave, but I still have that howler of a cold, and I'm afraid I'm going to have to kind of cuff that part of the broadcast again this week. What I'll do is I'll drop in a reading that Sally and I did a while back of an old article from the naughty 90s called 40 Questions on the Holocaust.
What proof exists that the Nazis practiced genocide or deliberately killed 6 million Jews?
None. The only evidence is the contradictory testimony of individual survivors, and no survivor claims actually to have witnessed any gassing. There is no hard evidence whatsoever. No mounds of ashes, no piles of clothes, no crematoria capable of doing the job, no human soap, no lampshades made out of human skin, no records, no demographic statistics. On the other hand, there exists extensive evidence of a forensic, demographic, analytical, documentary, anecdotal, and comparative nature, which clearly proves the impossibility of such a figure as 6 million Jewish dead, an exaggeration of possibly 1,000%.
How did German concentration camps differ from American relocation camps, which interned Japanese and German Americans during World War II?
Except for the name, the only difference was that the Germans interned persons who were a real or suspected threat to the German war effort, whereas the Americans interned persons on the basis of their race or national origin alone.
Why did the German authorities intern Jews in the concentration camps?
Because the Germans considered the Jews a direct threat to their national sovereignty and survival, correctly as it turned out. Jews were overwhelmingly represented in Germany in communist subversion during the Weimar period. On a per capita basis, Jews were highly overrepresented in government, commercial, and media positions. However, all suspected security risks, not just Jews, were in danger of internment once the war broke out. On March 24, 1933, international Jewry declared war on Germany and ordered a worldwide boycott of German goods simply because the German government had removed Jews from influential positions and transferred power back to the German people. The boycott order and the Jewish war against Germany were reported in the world print and broadcast media of the time. False stories of German death camps were in fact circulated even before the outbreak of World War II. Therefore, the German view of the Jewish people as enemy aliens would seem to have been fully justified.
Did Simon Wiesenthal once admit that there were never any death camps on German soil?
Yes, in Books and Bookmen, April 1975 issue, he claims the gassing of all the Jews took place in Poland.
Dachau is in Germany. If even Simon Wiesenthal now admits it was not a death camp, why do thousands of American veterans say it was?
Because after the Allies captured Dachau, and incidentally murdered dozens of the former staff without trial, thousands of GIs were led through the camp and shown buildings alleged to be gas chambers. This story was later quietly expunged from official Holocaust lore because it became too difficult to maintain in the face of known fact, and because Dachau was in the Allied occupation zone where access to the camp was too easy and unrestricted. En passant, the brief lifespan of the Dachau death camp version gave rise to the first critical examination and questioning of the Holocaust myth by historians and by some Allied veterans who noticed discrepancies in what they had seen and what they read in official accounts. It would be many years, though, before this early Holocaust revisionism gained momentum.
Auschwitz is in Poland, not Germany. Is there any proof that gas chambers for the purpose of killing people existed at Auschwitz?
No. The gas chamber exhibited to tourists at Auschwitz could not possibly have been used to carry out executions. It is far too small, and it's not even airtight. In the 1980s, American expert Fred Luchter, who builds gas chambers for American penal systems, took scrapings from the walls of the Auschwitz gas chamber for chemical analysis. He found no cyanide residue at all. The Auschwitz exhibit is a fake, pure and simple. A flimsy tourist trap.
If Auschwitz wasn't a death camp, what was its true purpose?
It was a large-scale manufacturing complex. Synthetic rubber called Buna was made there, and its inmates were used as a workforce, in the same way in which inmate labor is increasingly being used in correctional systems throughout the United States today.
What about the infamous Zyklon B gas?
Zyklon B is a commercially manufactured compound of hydrocyanic gas. It has a number of widespread industrial uses, including the fumigation of lice-infested clothing, the purpose for which it was applied at Auschwitz. Zyklon B is still manufactured worldwide and is commonly used and available today.
If Auschwitz was not an extermination camp, why did former Commandant Rudolf Höss confess that it was?
Hus was captured by the Russians and Polish communists and brutally tortured. He signed his confession, which is the sole source for the figure of 6 million dead Jews, in English, a language that he could not read. Some pages of the original document are literally stained with Hus's blood. Hus was then conveniently executed so he could not be cross-examined.
How long does it take to fully ventilate an area fumigated with Cyclone B?
About 20 hours. The whole procedure is extremely involved and technical. Gas masks have to be used and well-trained technicians only are employed.
Rudolf Hus said in his confession that his men would enter the gas chamber 10 minutes after the Jews had died and remove the bodies. How do you explain this?
It can't be explained because it couldn't have happened like that. Had the Germans done this, they would have suffered the same fate as the allegedly exterminated Jews.
Hus said in his confession that his men would smoke cigarettes as they pulled dead Jews out of chambers, which 10 minutes before had been filled with gas. Isn't Zyklon B explosive?
Highly so. The Hus confession is obviously false, and the 6 million figure as well.
How could such a mass murder program have been kept secret from Jews who were scheduled for execution? How could the Pope, the Vatican, the International Red Cross, and Allied military intelligence not know?
Given the acknowledged efficiency and penetration of the OSS, British MI5, and the Soviet NKVD into the Third Reich, it could not have been kept secret, nor can one imagine any reason for the Allies who were fighting to destroy Germany not to make use of such a potentially powerful propaganda weapon, had there been any contemporary evidence at all during the war that such an event was occurring.
How many Jews actually died in German concentration camps during the war?
About 300,000.
And how did they die?
Mainly from recurring typhus epidemics that ravaged war-torn Europe during the period. Typhus is a disease which invariably appears whenever people are jammed together for long periods without bathing. It's carried by lice, which infects hair and clothes. Ironically, if the Germans had used more Zyklon B for disinfectant purposes, more Jews might have survived the concentration camps. Jewish prisoners, as well as many others, also died from starvation and lack of medical attention. Towards the end of the war, when virtually all rail and road transport had come to a standstill due to the intense Allied bombing campaign.
What is the difference whether 6 million Jews or 300,000 died?
5,700,000. The key question is whether or not there was a deliberate, systematic attempt on the part of the Third Reich to exterminate the Jews of Europe. The evidence clearly shows that there was not, and the focus of world attention now needs to shift to the identity, the activities, and the financial and political motivations of those who have inflicted on all humanity for the past 70 years the grotesque, slanderous, and evil lie that there was a Holocaust.
Many Jewish survivors of the death camps say they saw bodies being piled up in pits and burned. How much gasoline would have been used to perform this act?
A lot more than the Germans had access to or could have afforded to waste during the Second World War, that's for sure.
Can bodies be burned in pits?
No, it's impossible for human bodies to be totally consumed by flames in this manner, as not enough heat can be generated in open pits. It is impossible to completely destroy human bodies en masse with either gasoline, napalm, or in any other way in open pits. The Holocaust experts who claim otherwise are either parroting what they have been told without bothering to check their facts, or else they're lying.
Holocaust authors claim the Nazis were able to cremate bodies in about 10 minutes. How long does it take to incinerate a body according to professional funeral operators?
About 2 hours.
Why did concentration camps have crematory ovens?
To dispose efficiently and sanitarily of the corpses dead from typhus and other diseases.
Given a 100% duty cycle of all the known crematoria in all the camps in German-controlled territory, what is the maximum number of corpses which it would have been possible to incinerate during the entire time the camps were in existence?
About 430,600.
Can a crematory oven be operated 100% of the time?
No. 50% of the time is a very generous estimate, or 12 hours per day. Crematory ovens have to be cleaned thoroughly and regularly when in heavy operation.
On the average, how much ash is left from a cremated corpse?
After the bone is ground down into powder, a separate, time-consuming process in itself, about a shoebox full.
If 6 million people were incinerated by the Nazis, what happened to the ashes?
Well, that remains to be explained. 6 million bodies would produce literally mountains of ash, tons upon tons. Yet there have been no discoveries of any huge deposits of ash in the Auschwitz area or anywhere else in Europe.
Do Allied wartime photos of Auschwitz taken from the air show any signs of crematoria in full blast operation?
No. These photographs do not reveal even a trace of the immense amount of smoke which must have hung constantly over the camp, nor do they show any evidence of the alleged open pits where the bodies were burned.
What did the International Red Cross have to say about the whole Holocaust issue?
A report of the visit of an IRC delegation to Auschwitz in September of 1944 pointed out that internees were allowed to receive packages and that rumors of gas chambers could not be verified. The full official report of the International Red Cross on the Second World War makes no mention at all of the so-called Holocaust or any of the wilder allegations connected with the so-called Holocaust. Interestingly, in 2011, over 70 years after the war's end, the liberal media in America and Europe began running a series of articles claiming that the Red Cross was full of Nazi sympathizers. This charge is entirely bogus, and it may be chalked up to belated Jewish attempts at damage control as the Holocaust myth crumbles steadily in the light of factual examination and critical analysis.
Is the diary of Anne Frank genuine?
Not as published, no. The evidence compiled by Dietleib Felderer of Sweden and Dr. Robert Faurisson of France proves conclusively that the published version of the famous diary is a literary hoax. There was a girl named Anne Frank, and sections of the diary appear to be genuine, including several wherein she describes adolescent lesbian sexual experiences which were later excised from the published text. In 1950, Anne Frank's father sued author Meyer Levin, the actual writer of the diary, over royalties from the book. A Jewish judge in New York ordered the records of the court case sealed for 100 years. When the original diary was put on display a few years later, it was noticed that the most poignant sections of the book were interpolations written in a forged handwriting in ballpoint pen, a writing instrument which was not invented until 1950. The original diary was swiftly removed from exhibit and whisked away into a safety deposit box in Israel. It has never been produced for examination since then, despite repeated attempts by scholars to view it.
What about all the numerous photographs and film footage allegedly taken in German concentration camps showing emaciated corpses and people? Are these faked?
Well, some are, but most of the fakery lies in the captioning. Corpses of German air raid victims, for example, are labeled as dead Jews. One famous and oft-reprinted photo purports to show a quote-unquote Nazi SS man about to shoot a mother holding her child. On closer examination of the blurry print with a magnifying glass, it is clear to military historians familiar with the uniforms and weapons of the period that the killer is a Red Army soldier wielding a Russian-made carbine. The exterminationist habit of blaming the Germans for atrocities actually carried out by the Soviet dictator Joseph Stalin remains common, even though some of the more notorious examples, like the Katyn Forest massacre of Polish prisoners, have now been properly laid at the door of the Kremlin. That this kind of fraud continues to be perpetrated by Holocaust experts is not surprising in view of the fact that almost all of them espouse Marxist or extreme left-wing views and are as quick to apologize for and explain away Stalin's butcheries as they are to invent fraudulent crimes attributed to Adolf Hitler. The almost universally leftist political and social orientation of Holocaust defenders is important and should always be borne in mind when examining their claims. Letting Stalin off the hook is almost as important to them as blackening and defaming the memory of Hitler and the German people.
What was the role of the Vatican during the time in which 6 million Jews were allegedly exterminated?
Had there been an extermination plan being carried out in a predominantly Catholic country like Poland, the Vatican would certainly have been in a position to learn about it. Since no such plan existed, the Vatican had no need to speak out about it.
What evidence is there that Adolf Hitler ordered the extermination of the Jews?
None. No documentary evidence of any kind indicating a deliberate extermination plan on the part of the Nazis has ever come to light. No signed order from Hitler, from Reichsfuhrer SS Heinrich Himmler, or from any other functionary of the Third Reich ordering the extermination of the Jews has ever been discovered. The Nazis were meticulous records keepers, and literally tons of documents were seized by the Allies at the end of the war. So many that it took Allied archivists and scholars years to organize, file, and catalog them all. Nothing. Zip. Nada.
Did the Germans and the Zionists collaborate before and during the war?
Absolutely. Both groups were interested in removing the Jews from Europe. The Zionists wanted the Jews shipped to Palestine, and they maintained friendly relations throughout the war. The German official in charge of shipping thousands of Jews to then-British-occupied Palestine, including future Israeli Prime Minister Menachem Begin, was Adolf Eichmann. After the war, the Holocaust industry considered this secret so volatile and dangerous that Eichmann was abducted by the Israeli Mossad and subsequently murdered in order to silence him.
How many Jews were in areas which came to be controlled by the Germans during the Second World War?
Slightly less than 4 million.
How many Jews fled deep into the Soviet Union to escape the Nazis?
Over 2 million. The Germans didn't have access to them to kill them.
If European Jews weren't exterminated by the Nazis, what happened to them?
Well, after the war, most Jews emigrated to Palestine, the United States, Argentina, Canada, and Great Britain. Except for about 300,000, they're all accounted for.
How does the Holocaust story benefit the Jewish people today?
It shields them from any criticism over their political, economic, and social behavior. It's instrumental in raising immense sums of guilt money, especially from the German government. It justifies aid to the State of Israel, totaling almost $10 billion per year from various sources. Israel has received almost $70 billion in assorted Holocaust reparations, and the ante is growing every year. It's clearly in the interest of Israel and the Jewish people to keep the scam going.
Are films like Holocaust, Schindler's List, and The Winds of War documentaries?
Hollywood movies are not history, and they're not intended to be. They are fictionalized dramas. The characters in movies are actors, not real people, who are being very highly paid for their portrayal of events that did not in fact occur. They read their lines from a screenplay written by Hollywood scriptwriters, a profession where Jews are very highly overrepresented, as they are in the studios and the creative and the financial sectors of filmmaking. Hollywood is such an extremely unreliable source of history that in recent years even mainstream reviewers and commentators have begun to express doubt and suspicion over certain films. For example, the character of Oscar Schindler, as portrayed by Liam Neeson in Spielberg's production of Schindler's List, was sanitized to the point of being unrecognizable. Schindler was portrayed as almost saintly, and yet none of those still living who remember the man have a single good word to say about him. The real Schindler was a confidence artist, a thief, a libertine, and a degenerate gambler who indulged freely in forced sexual relations with young female camp inmates. He later abandoned his wife and fled with his mistress to Brazil after embezzling a large sum of money. Other major directors, like Oliver Stone, have come under fire because their portrayals of historical characters like Nixon and events like the JFK assassination reflect a paranoid obsession with the most bizarre of left-wing conspiracy theories.
About how many books have been published which refute some aspect of the standard Jewish claims about the Holocaust?
Over 100, with more in the works.
But aren't all those who question the Holocaust anti-Semitic or neo-Nazis?
Some are. Although why such people should be denied the same right to advance their viewpoint which liberal democracy grants so freely to Jews and liberals in this purportedly free society is never explained. Most revisionists, however, are academics, genuine scholars who seek only the truth. Many hold liberal or libertarian views, although these views often change, as they're subjected to the intense persecution which accompanies any deviation from the official orthodoxy on the Holocaust.
What has happened to historians who dispute the official version of the Holocaust?
A variety of unpleasant things. Significantly, the Jews have always refused to debate the facts of the Holocaust openly with revisionists. An internet group allegedly set up for this purpose called NISCOR does not in fact debate revisionists, but engages in hysterical campaigns of ad hominem abuse against anyone who dares to express any dissent or doubt regarding the Holocaust. It's clear from many of the postings to NISCOR's internet playgroups that they have attracted a number of people, mostly Jews but some left liberal Gentiles as well, who are motivated by intense racial bigotry and ideological hatred of anyone who disagrees with them, and who in some cases appear to be severely mentally and emotionally disturbed. The Jews respond to any questioning of the Holocaust with hatred, violence, and persecution, which in itself is the surest giveaway that they have something to hide. In many countries, those who ask politically incorrect or searching questions about the Holocaust are arrested, tortured, and imprisoned. Dr. Robert Farrison was assaulted by a Jewish gang who beat him so badly that he was almost crippled. In California, a major revisionist bookseller's offices were burned, and in Toronto, revisionist author Ernst Zundel's home was almost destroyed in an arson attack. Zundel himself was subjected to a bizarre series of show trials lasting over 10 years by the Canadian government, and after finally being acquitted, he was denied Canadian citizenship and eventually deported to Germany, where he spent 5 years in prison for questioning the official version of that country's history. An American citizen, Gerhard Lauck of Lincoln, Nebraska, was kidnapped by the German government and served a lengthy prison sentence in Germany for the so-called crime of writing pro-National Socialist commentary in the United States, where it is legal. Another American citizen, Hans Schmidt of Florida, was also abducted, held in prison in Germany for almost a year, and released only after an international outcry. Schmidt's so-called crime was writing a pro-revisionist article in English, in a newsletter published and distributed in the United States. German nationalist Manfred Reuter has been imprisoned so many times he's lost count. Revisionists have been stripped of jobs and academic posts, denied tenure in universities, victimized by harassing lawsuits, received bombs in the mail, and subjected to constant death threats from Jews and Marxists. These are not the reactions of innocent people. Innocent people who are accused of a crime or a fraud do not respond by trying to kill, imprison, or forcibly silence their accusers. More than anything else, the behavior of the Jews and the governments they influence so strongly proves that the Holocaust is a fraud. If the Holocaust was true, neither the Jews nor any state authority would need to use force to silence criticism, any more than force need be used against people who believe the earth is flat. The arrests, imprisonment, assaults, and torchings are the moral equivalent of a full confession on the part of the Jewish people that they are contemptible liars who have imposed the most massive and vicious hoax in history on all of humanity, and who have used that hoax as an excuse to rob us blind, steal another people's country, and then to slaughter that country's original inhabitants at will.
Have these thuggish tactics succeeded in silencing revisionists?
No. They have only made revisionists more determined than ever to ensure that the truth comes out and that the nations of the earth understand how the Jewish people have lied to them, defrauded them, and robbed them for over a century now with the Holocaust lie. There can be little doubt that in succeeding generations the Holocaust will be accepted by mainstream historians and the public at large for what it is, a politically inspired hoax. And of course, in any selection of 1960s music regarding the Weathermen and Power to the People and the Revolution Man, there is only one song that we can conclude with, one that I remember very distinctly from those days, and which, in my view, is still pretty good. I'll be honest with you guys, someday in the future, when time and place shall serve, and when we can give it meaning, I want us and the NVA and the Northwest Independence Movement to steal this song from the Reds. Basically, there are some things that are just too good for those hippy-dippy shits to have, and this is one of them. This is Jefferson Airplane.
Volunteers of America, volunteers of America, volunteers.
We got a really good reaction last week off the discussion session I broadcast between myself and Sally and Wallace. And sometime in the next few days, I'm going to see if I can get them both in here at the same time and do another one. When I do, I very much hope that I don't give either of them this cold that I have at the moment, because the fact is that we have only one mic. Yes, folks, this little program of ours, which is beginning to be correctly described by a lot of people not associated in any way with the Northwest Front as the most interesting and professional podcast on the racial right, this little program of ours is actually produced on a battered home computer, parts of which are about 14 years old, and through one single Samson PS01 microphone, which was donated by a supporter. When we do multiple-person live podcasts, everybody has to crowd into a little room and hover over the mic, which is not a good idea when one of the people involved has an infectious disease, as I do at the moment. I really would like to have a proper internet radio recording and production studio with all the necessary software and hardware, a mixing board, multiple microphones, facilities for doing call-ins, so forth and so on, but we just don't have the money for it. Now, those of you who are on the Northwest Observer list will recall that I mentioned in my fall building campaign letter of a few weeks ago that this is one of the things I hope to acquire once you guys understand that, yes, I really do mean you, and you open your checkbooks. I don't just sit here in an ivory tower all day writing, although I really, really wish I could, because that's where I think I can do the most good for the 14 words. Now, people want to know when the second half of Freedom Sons will start to come out, and when am I going to do this, and when am I going to do that? Until such time as we can locate and motivate and activate that national organizer chappie I keep driveling on about, it seems to be pretty much up to me to drag the party forward another few agonizing inches every couple of years. Now, I'm not very good at the actual organizing stuff, I admit that, since among other things I'm a misanthrope, but there's no one else. For that, we need better premises where we can set up an internet production studio. Or if not, we need to revamp and reorganize our present shabby domicile and turn this little room into one. But in any case, we will need not just the technical expertise of all our computer geeks, but money as well. So if you haven't made a contribution yet to the fall building campaign, please do so. I know times are hard economically, but just think what life's going to be like if nobody does anything about what's going on. I can only do what you give me the resources to do. The resource I want from you most is your ass up here in the Northwest homeland where you're supposed to be. But if that can't happen, I admit a check with a man-sized number of zeros on it is an adequate substitute for now. Kind of like the first conscription in 1863 in the Union during the Civil War, when a man who was drafted could buy his way out of it for $300. Yeah, I know, that's a bad comparison. But politics is the art of the possible, and nothing is possible without money. Well, our time is up, and so that's it for this week's edition of Radio Free Northwest. This program is brought to you by the Northwest Front, Post Office Box 4856, Seattle, Washington, 98104. Or you can go to the party's website at www.northwestfront.org. This is Harold Covington, and I'll see you next week. Until then, Sarsha Andaban. Freedom. Rising on.